This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva with another installment of Jews, Judaism, and Modernity, our Jewish history series here at webyeshiva.org. Before we turn our attention to Western Europe, I'd like to continue a little bit of our discussion of Eastern Europe and the rise of anti-Semitism at the end of the 19th and beginning of 20th century. In order to do that, we're going to break a little bit with our chronology. When we last left off, we were in the early 1880s, and I want to jump ahead quite a bit, 20-some-odd years, because I want to get to a larger point that we hinted at last time, and then when we meet again next week, I think we'll already be back in our familiar haunts in Berlin, talking about the rise of anti-Semitism in Western Europe, and how that, of course, led to its hugely tragic consequences in the middle part of the 20th century, and how these two streams of anti-Jewishness, anti-Semitism, come together. I want to jump ahead to the year 1903, to Kishinev. Kishinev may be a pogrom that's familiar to you, for reasons which we'll get to. Kishinev is in what today is called Moldova, which was a Soviet republic that broke away and gained independence in the early 1990s, probably 1991 or so. But at the time of the pogrom, it was part of Bessarabia, which is a kind of neighbor of what today we call the Ukraine. You can see where Moldova is here on the map, or on the larger map. Hold on a second, let me just make this a drop smaller. Even smaller still. There you go. Here's Kishinev, the capital city of current-day Moldova, which is surrounded on three sides, as it were, two sides, as it were, by the Ukraine to the east and Romania to the west. It's this landlocked country, small little country, cut off from the Black Sea by this little piece of the Ukraine, which juts out. The Dniester River is a main... the main river here. There were many Jewish shtetlach and towns all along this area. And here's Kishinev. Here's Kishinev today. In April of 1903, the week before Pesach and Easter, the coincidence of those two holidays is never usually a very good thing. Never good for the Jews. On April 6th, which was a few days before Pesach, in 1903, there was a Christian boy was found murdered in a small town called, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Dubasari. You see, here it is on the map. It's about, I don't know, 20, 30 miles north of Kishinev. And the newspapers, the Russian newspapers, spun the murder of this, or the death of this Russian boy as basically a blood libel. The old canard that the Jews needed the blood of a Christian to bake the matzot before Pesach. This was an old medieval, anti-Semitic ruse, which was revived from time to time, and a pogrom breaks out in Kishinev, which was a larger center of Jewish population, and it goes on for 3 days. There are different reports about exactly how many people are killed. The more accepted seem to be something around in the high 40s, maybe 47 or 49 people, Jews, that is, are killed. Many, of course, many hundreds are wounded, either severely or less so. And there's a tremendous amount of property damage. Hundreds of houses are destroyed, are looted, are burnt to the ground. Synagogues are destroyed. There's this image, one of the more evocative images of to come out of the pogrom, of this funeral for the Sifrei Torah that were desecrated. You know, our the halacha is that if a Sefer Torah, if a Torah scroll has been desecrated, it's buried. And so they had this mass funeral, as it were, for the Sifrei Torah. These are aronot, coffins, for the desecrated Torah scrolls, which were buried in a funeral. This is any time you look up something about the Kishinev pogrom, this particular image comes about. I guess in 1903 there were still not a tremendous amount of photographic documentation of things, but this is of course one of the images. Like we said last time, one of the features of modern anti-Semitism is the government both greasing the wheels and standing idly by, instead of fulfilling their responsibility to keep law and order. The government both fosters and encourages and sits passively by while it's going on. The police and the army really don't do anything to get involved or to stop the looting and the rioting. And this goes on for 3 days. The New York Times reports on, hold on a second. The New York Times reports on the massacre. This is an article from, why is this not working? There you go. This is from an article from April 28th of that year. The anti-Jewish riots in Kishinev, Bessarabia, are worse than the censor will permit to publish, meaning the Russian censor. There was a well-laid-out plan for the general massacre of Jews on the day following the Russian Easter. The mob was led by priests, and the general cry, "Kill the Jews," was taken up all over the city. The Jews were taken wholly unaware and were slaughtered like sheep. The dead number 120, and the injured about 500. Again, contemporary figures are a little less, not quite that many killed. The scenes of horror attending this massacre are beyond description. Babes were literally torn to pieces by the frenzied and bloodthirsty mob. The local police made no attempt to check the reign of terror. At sunset, the streets were piled with corpses and wounded. Those who could make their escape fled in terror, and the city is now practically deserted of Jews. A contemporary account of the pogrom says, shortly before Easter, when the bishop of the Greek church in the Kishinev province was asked to contradict the absurd rumor that a Jew murdered a young man for their ritual at Passover, this high priest publicly stated that he himself believed the story of Jews using Christian bloods for ritual purposes. The semi-official newspaper openly preached the extermination of Jews for months. Again, the frenzy that the crowds are worked into by the organs of the state it's remarkable in its lack of and its lack of responsibility. All applications for permission to publish a more impartial paper have been repeatedly refused. The control of the press and the organs of communication, of course, are essential for the propaganda effort to create an environment in which a pogrom can erupt. Again, I apologize. If you have a webcam, please hit the send video button so that I can see your faces. Hello, Alan. Howard, Belova, Natalia, Barbara. Okay, there you go. Beseder. And still, when the actual massacres began, the governor, it is said now, failed for 2 days to obtain orders from the ministry and the Tsar in St. Petersburg to use military force against the housebreakers and murderers. Moreover, he refused in the course of those 2 days any communication with the suffering Jewish population, never left his private quarters, closed all the phones in the town to the public, and prohibited the sending of any private telegrams from Kishinev to St. Petersburg. So again, that kind of, the official, hear no evil, see no evil, pretend it's not happening, create an environment in which no one can come in and regain law and order and peace and maintain the public safety, and to let it just spin out of control. Now again, this is remarkable because throughout the medieval and early modern periods, even though the government, the European governments, were never, may not have been great lovers of the Jews, they generally did fulfill their responsibilities of maintaining law and order, if for no other reason than the just the practical self-interest that it's not in their interest to have rioting and houses being burned down and etc. If somebody's house has been burned down, if somebody's farm has been destroyed, they tend not to have the wherewithal to pay their taxes, and that's something that the government generally is interested in having its residents do. So even without any kind of motivation of great love of Jews, there's all types of reasons that a government might want to keep law and order. The police of the town not only refused to render any efficient protection and assistance to the attacked and murdered Jewish population, but deliberately prevented by force any assistance being rendered to them by those private persons who were willing to do so. The police actually pointed out Jewish houses to the rioters. Whenever Jews themselves attempted to gather to show armed resistance, the police and military instantly attacked, disarmed, and dispersed them. The results of this terrible circumstance are awful. And here's more statistics which may or may not jive with the historical record. This is a contemporary account. 118 Jews, men, women, and children have already been buried. Over 200 cases of serious injury. Over 1,000 cases of lighter injury. 800 Jewish houses destroyed and demolished, 600 shops and stores broken into and looted. Over 400 Jewish families have been rendered 400. Oh, I'm sorry. I think that's 400, but the copy is smudged. Have been rendered homeless and destitute. It's been learned that there were about 12,000 troops in Kishinev at the time. Against 200 to 300 active rioters and housebreakers. Now, let's take these numbers for granted. But let's even imagine they're exaggerated by 50%. There are thousands of Russian troops, army troops, in the vicinity. And there are a couple of hundred rioters doing this damage. And yet the military, the police, they're sitting on their hands letting it happen. And as soon as the government chose to proclaim martial law after 2 days, all disorders stopped instantly. The government was able to shut it off like a faucet, but didn't do it to the great detriment of the Jewish population. Again, the historical record, one reporter account, another eyewitness account, great diversity of statistics, but the picture that's being painted is all the same. the picture that's being painted is all the same. These pogroms and another round of pogroms, Dafka, specifically in the same area, in the Kishinev area, just 2 years later, in 1905, are really flashpoints. Of course, there were other pogroms throughout the Russian Empire, in Poland, elsewhere, but somehow the Kishinev pogrom becomes a litmus test. It becomes the I'm sorry, hold on 1 second, please, folks. I'm sorry, folks. The Kishinev pogroms become a symbol of a new trend in what's happening in Eastern Europe, and like we said last time, really do become a harbinger of things to come, but also a light of fire underneath the notion that we need to do something and we need to get out of here. And both emigration to America as well as Russian Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael are both fueled very much by these events. The pogroms also had a very profound impact on the imagination of anshei ruach, of people of letters, of writers, authors, playwrights, and perhaps none more so than Bialik. Bialik, I trust, is a name that's familiar to you. The great Chaim Nachman Bialik, we call him the national poet of the Jewish world. Bialik is born in 1873. He lives till 1934. He has a traditional upbringing. He studies in cheder and yeshivot, even though he has something of a very unhappy childhood. His father dies when he's very young. He's sent away by his mother to his grandfather, who's this kind of picture of a stern rabbinic grandfather. He's sent off to cheder. He's sent off to yeshiva. He studies in the Volozhin yeshiva. Those experiences, you know, very much play into his poetry. Perhaps his most, one of his greatest poems, Hamatmid. Hamatmid, which I think is translated as the yeshiva student or the Talmud scholar. Hamatmid, the student who, like the nail, banged into the bench of the yeshiva, the stool of the yeshiva, Beit Midrash, who doesn't leave, who literally becomes like part of the furniture of the Beit Midrash, a depiction of life, of yeshiva life, which is both nostalgic and at the same time biting in its depiction, is among his more well-known poems. Around the age of 18, he breaks with traditional life, but not with Judaism. And he becomes a figure, a kind of new figure, not a maskil in the sense that we've seen in our discussions of the past, but someone very much committed to Jewish life, and very much committed to creating a secular Jewish culture, a national culture, which will become very important in Palestine, in Eretz Yisrael, in the years before the establishment of the state. And Bialik, of course, is one of the important figures in that movement. After the pogroms in Kishinev, while still living in Russia, he's sent by a commission from Odessa to do like a fact-finding mission to prepare a report of what was seen and what happened in Kishinev. And he does. He goes and he writes that. That report. But he also distills his experience of seeing the destruction, the days after destruction, in a poem called Be'ir HaHarega. Be'ir HaHarega, in the city of slaughter. The city of slaughter. One of his most famous poems. All of his poems can be found on this website, benyehuda.org/Bialik. I've uploaded to our Shir homepage a very fine side-by-side edition. You can download the PDF of the translation. This translation by Klein with the, you know, line, you see the lines are numbered here so that you can go line by line and correspond between the Hebrew text and the English text. It's quite long. I think it's about, I think it's about 22, 23 pages to print out the whole poem in both Hebrew and in English. And it's worth the effort to make your way through beautiful Hebrew poetry with the aid of a line-by-line translation to try to get at what he's doing. The poem begins. We obviously can't read the whole thing. It's something of an epic poem. But just for the sake of hearing the beauty of Bialik's Hebrew, let's just read a little bit. Kum, lech lecha el ir haharega. Uvata el achatzerot. Uveinecha tire, uviadcha timashesh, al hagderot. Vaal haetzim, vaal haavanim, vaal gabe tiachak talim, al hadam hakarush, veet hamoach haniksha, shel hachalalim. The poem, we'll just look at a couple of highlights in the translation. Kum lech lecho el ir haharega, arise and go now to the city of slaughter. The resonance of lech lecha. Let me go back to the Hebrew text. The resonance of lech lecha, I trust, is not lost on you. Go now to the city of slaughter. Into its courtyard wind thy way. There with thy own hand touch, and with the eyes of thine head, behold, on tree, on stone, on fence, on mural clay, the spattered blood and dried brains of the dead. Proceed thence to the ruins, the split walls reach, where wider grows the hollow, and greater grows the breach. Now, you always have to be wary of reading translated poetry which rhymes. In other words, there are two ways to translate poetry. You can either aim for an accurate translation, or you can aim to try to preserve the cadence and the rhyme of the original poem. But in order to, you can't have both. So Klein, who translated Bialik into English, by definition, you have to err on one side or the other. So he errs on the side of trying to preserve the poetic voice, but in order to make the lines rhyme, you have to. It's like there used to be a sitter, the DeSolo Pool sitter, thus called after the name of the translator, Rabbi DeSolo Pool. It was a fairly common sitter I don't know, probably 30 years ago in America, prior to the advent of the Art Scroll Sitter. And it had this weird, you remember this sitter? The DeSola, it was the RCA sitter. It was used in a lot of the modern Orthodox synagogues in the United States. It had this weird, oh yeah, really? They still use it in Lincoln Square? That's interesting. It has this weird feature of whenever there's an acrostic poem, like Ashrei. Ashrei is acrostic. Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha, Od Yelu Chasela. Ashrei Amshakachala, Ashrei Amshanamev. B'chol Yom Avarchecha. Aleph Bet, Gimel Dalet Hey, etc. Kael Adon, on Shabbat morning. Kael Adon, Al Kol HaMasim. Bet, Baruch Umvaruch, B'fi Kol Neshama. Gimel, God love it to vote. Each line starts with a different Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, according to the alphabet. It's an acrostic. He would translate it acrostically. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, wherever possible. I think he'd skip Q's and X's just because it wasn't that many hoops he couldn't jump through. In order to do that, he had to convolute the meaning to fit the acrostic in such a way that you know you're bound to lose something. So here, whenever you read poetry in translation, you have to be wary. If you hear the rhyme, that means probably that comes at the expense of a very precise translation. Although sometimes better, sometimes worse. And again, I'll just restate what I've mentioned in the past. Whenever you look to works of the imagination or works of art, literature, fiction, as historical sources, you of course have to bear in mind what it is that you're doing. You don't turn to a poem any more than you turn to an Agnon story, which we've done a number of times, I mean, mostly because of my own deep interest and love for Agnon. You don't turn to it as historical record. Even historical record, you can't turn to as historical record, as we saw. What did we just look at? We looked at one contemporary source, an eyewitness account, and we looked at a New York Times news article, and the disparity just in the pure statistics is remarkable. And neither of them seem to correspond with what contemporary historians now tell us. So even historical records, documents that purport to be objective, have to be viewed with a certain amount of suspicion. Alachas kama vakama, when you look at works of the imagination, such as art or literature, when we turn to a poem, we're not turning to it for the historical fact, the kind of nitty gritty, the details of excavating historical, but we turn to it for filling in a larger sense, a larger notion of what's going on. There's a journal, a very noteworthy journal called Proof Text. You can Google it and find it online. I uploaded to the password protected our course's homepage a couple of articles from a journal a couple of years ago that was dedicated exclusively to Kishinev and to this poem, to Bialik's poem, including a question of the historicity of it, and does Bialik, to what degree does he accurately capture what we know about the historicity? That's a different kind of question. It's an important kind of question. But that's not why I'm looking to Bialik now. I'm looking to Bialik now to help us get at a different feeling, something that can't be shown or proven statistically or through the hard data of historical fact. I'm looking for something else, which I hope will become apparent through looking at the poem. But for the other background stuff, look at those PDFs that are up on the Shiur homepage, on the course homepage. Pass over the shattered hearth, attain the broken wall, whose burnt and barren brick, whose charred stones reveal, the open mouths of such wounds that no mending shall ever mend, nor healing ever heal. There will thy feet in feathers sink and stumble on wreckage doubly wrecked, scroll heaped on manuscript, fragments against fragmented. Pause not upon this havoc, go thy way. So he's inviting the observer to come in. Lech lecha, go, just like Hashem calls to Avraham to embark on this, on his historical odyssey. Bialik is calling to who? Who's he addressing in the poem? No? Who's being addressed here? Who's he calling to? Who's he inviting to come see what happened in Kishinev? Nu, are you out there? So he's calling to the Jews. He's calling to the Jews of the world to see what's happened here. He says, you're going to come, you're going to see bashed brains and clotted blood and dead babies and wreckage. And you're going to see scroll heaped upon manuscript, desecrated Torah scrolls strewn throughout the streets. Pause not upon this havoc. That's not what you should be looking at. Go thy way. Keep going. Lech lecha. Right? Keep going. Keep going weiter. Because there's something deeper. There's maybe even a deeper havoc, a deeper damage that you have to see. This translation of the poem is abridged. It's not the whole thing. These ellipses are here to tell you that. Let me just skip ahead. I have a printed copy here. Sorry, one sec. Descend then to the cellars of the town, there where the virginal daughters of thy folk were fouled, where seven heathen flung a woman down, the daughter of the presence in her mother, the mother in the presence of her daughter. Before slaughter, during slaughter, and after slaughter. Touch with thy hand the cushion stained, touch the pillow incarnadined, I think reddened with blood. This is the place the wild ones of the wood, the beasts of the field, with bloody axes in their paws, compelled thy daughters yield, beasted and swined. There are resonances and references and malitzot here to psukim, of course. The whole thing is written. What the genre in which it's written? What is it? Does it remind you of something? What are you hearing when you hear the lines? Does it sound from not the words, but the tone? Does it sound familiar to you from something? It's obviously echoing both the Tochacha, the passages in the Torah that describe the ravages of the destruction of what will be wreaked upon the Jewish people, but also the Kinot, the Tisha B'Av elegies, the Kinot of Tisha B'Av that we recite sitting on the floor on Tisha B'Av morning, mourning both the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, as well as all the other destructions that came in its wake throughout history. How would you say Kohelet? How do you see that? I'm not sure that if you can point out something specific. Okay. Note also, do not fail to note. Again, he's calling to the audience, to the listener, to the he's calling to the addressee, pay attention. There's something you're invited in to see this scene of destruction. So first you're overwhelmed just by the raw, grisly, grim picture of dead bodies laying around. He says, don't be distracted by that, as awful as it is. There are other, like an onion, you keep peeling away the layers of the onion, and we're going to get to the kernel of the real destruction, the real abuse. Note also, do not fail to note, in that dark corner and behind that cask, crouched husbands, bridegrooms, brothers, peering from the cracks, watching the sacred bodies struggling underneath the bestial breath. So as you have the scene where the women, the daughters, are being defiled, and the husbands and bridegrooms and brothers, and they're hiding behind you know, in the corner while this is going on. Stifled in filth and swallowing their blood, the lecherous rabble portioning for booty their kindred and their flesh. Crushed in their shame, they saw it all. They did not stir nor move. They did not pluck their eyes out. They beat not their brains against the wall. Perhaps each watcher had it in his heart to pray, a miracle, O Lord, and spare my skin this day. Those who survived this foulness, who from their blood awoke, beheld their life polluted, the light of their world gone out. How did their menfolk bear it? How did they bear this yoke? So after the pogrom, the survivors, particularly the men who were hiding behind, you know, in the cellar, so they're burdened with this yoke, with this sense that they were either unable or unwilling to do anything. They crawled forth from their holes. They fled to the house of the Lord, to the Beit Knesset. They offered thanks to him, the sweet benedictory word. The Kohanim sallied forth. To the rabbi's house they flitted. Tell me, O rabbi, tell me, is my own wife permitted? This, of course, is referring to the question of the Kedusha required of Kohanim and the halachic shelot that arise in the event that an eshet kohen, that a kohen's wife, should have been defiled, should have been raped, and what that means for their own continued marital life. Again, Bialik is spinning it in such a way that the focus on questions, which are real questions, these are real halachic issues, but the focus on those kinds of issues, the focus on, well, we should get ourselves to the Beit Midrash, but there's something else. It's playing out on another level, on another level as well. The matter ends, nothing more, and all is as it was before. Well, how can it be as it was before? How can we go on? How can we have been involved in this and somehow imagine that life will go back to the way it was? Come now, and I will bring thee to their lairs, the privies, jakes, and pigpens, where the heirs of Hasmoneans lay with trembling knees, concealed and cowering. The sons of the Maccabees? The seed of saints, the scions of lions, who crammed by scores all in all the sanctuaries of their shame, so sanctified my name. It was the flight of mice they fled. The scurrying of roaches was their flight. They died like dogs, and they were dead. Just look at The idea that the here we are a week before Hanukkah, that the Bnei Hashmonai, that the Maccabim, who were the Hashmonaim, who were the Maccabees? They are the image of Jews that knew how to fight back. And here are the descendants of those Hashmonaim. And they were crouching like mice, they fled, like roaches. They died like dogs, and they were dead. It's remarkable in that, in a very harsh way, not to say that, God forbid, Bialik is not suggesting that the Jews were responsible for the pogrom. We know who was responsible for the pogrom. But the biting criticism is not laid at the feet of the Russian mobs, and it's not laid at the feet of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Bialik's not asking questions about Tzadik Veralo. He's not turning to God and angrily saying, how could you have let this happen? He's not asking the question of where was God in Auschwitz or where was God in Kishinev. He's saying, where were the Jews? And this turn, this focus onto the question of, well, gee, what's our response? What can we do? What should we do? How should we protect ourselves? What should the Jewish response be? That is innovative. And that causes, again, the poem itself, although the poem itself was widely distributed, it was translated into, he of course wrote it in Hebrew, it was translated into Yiddish, into Russian, into Polish, it was widely distributed. But it's not that the poem caused a kind of societal change. The poem captured a notion, put into words a feeling that was this incipient feeling of the question of, well, who are we, Jewish people? And how do we respond to this kind of attack? And what should we be doing? And that becomes a very significant question. That becomes a question which will occupy the Jewish people for another 40 years, and then it will take on different meaning when, after those 40 years or 45 years, we get here to Eretz Yisrael, we get here to Medinat Yisrael, and are in a position to defend ourselves and defend our country in a very different way. And the poem captures something of that. The pogroms were this cataclysmic, I mean, all of the pogroms from the 1880s up until this period, but this one in particular, the pogroms were cataclysmic in the sense, not just, of course, for the tragic consequences for life and limb and property, but for how the Jewish people, the Jewish community in the Russian Empire start to think about themselves and start to think about where they stand vis-a-vis their oppressors and where they stand vis-a-vis a state or a nation which allows this to happen, which fosters it. And that begins to raise a slew of questions about what we as a Jewish people need to do in order to ameliorate those problems. So again, for your own reading, take a look at some of those essays about what Bialik was doing and to what degree the poem represents historical fact. But I'm arguing that that's secondary. It represents truth, even if it doesn't represent fact, or the degree to which it represents fact. Fact and truth are best friends, but they're not identical. And it's important to understand the relationship between the two as we look to sources to try to understand historical trends. Next week, we will turn back to the West and try to figure out what was going on there and the rise of anti-Semitism in that context. I will sign off now unless anybody has any specific questions, and we'll continue next week. Then, the names of who? Natalia, the names of who from both sides?